tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. So Venerable, chemical organized other form of heating. Didn't quite work. So this is an experiment in temperature regulation in a tent. And it's very much samsara, isn't it? You give it a good shot, but it goes the way it wants to sometimes. And it's a good thing to kind of reflect that Buddhism has both a social aspect, as I often say, and it has the aspect of what I like to call flow of consciousness. So the social aspect is the place of being active, being proactive, being responsible, creating things, trying things out, experimenting, making prototypes. It's the place we do things. And sometimes when we are thinking about awareness and flow of consciousness, it kind of sounds like it's just this sort of passive watching of events. And, you know, we just sit here and kind of freeze to death in the great liberation or something. But actually, as you can see, we're doing our very best to try to figure out how to use this tent in cold temperatures. So in Islam they have a saying, trust in Allah and tie your camel. In Christianity, I think Wellington was it, he said, trust in God and keep your powder dry. And in Buddhism we say, trust in Kamma and leave the rest to Dhamma. Because what can you do? I mean, you do your very best, and that's about intentions, and then skillfulness from a life of, an intelligent life of investigating and finding out how to cook and how to build and how to communicate and all the other things that we learn. I mean, one does one's very best, and then one just has to trust that the unfolding of life is the best you could do. And then as it unfolds, one adapts. So, you know, we do our very best we can here to create some warmth in the tent. And I'm sure we'll get two or three of these for next year. That probably is the solution. But it's oftentimes, more often than not, it's unsatisfactory. You know, this doesn't quite hit the mark. It's like kind of Murphy's Law. You know, if you make a jam sandwich, it will fall. If it falls, it will fall on the jam side. This is the worst corollary of Murphy's Law. That's the cynic in me, of course. I love that image. So you could be, one could be very cynical about things. Oh, it's always going to fail. You know, life is a bummer and then you die. You could go that way. Or, oh, life is wonderful, isn't it beautiful, and so on. Those are just mental positions that we take according to our moods, preferences, or how much money we have in the bank, or whatever. But in terms of liberation, the Buddha's pointing to the fact that liberation is through our inner work, but there are conditions which are very important and very helpful. So enough food, enough clothing, shelter, good companionship, these are all very important things. Stable society, all the war that's going on now, Ebola in Africa, you know, there's a lot of things that would be very, very hard to be mindful of. So those are important things. Unfortunately, we have them. We have political stability, you know, we have very good accommodation and food, so we're very, very fortunate that we can actually do this kind of more subtle work of watching stream of consciousness. We're very, very fortunate that way. And I think fortunate also that we have the interest in that we're not just willing to live a life of distraction and try to maximize pleasure in all kinds of social realms, that we see, well, there must be more to it than just the maximization of pleasure. There must be something deeper. And so the inspiration of the Buddha's enlightenment and the inspiration of the teachers that we have met and the books we have read and so on brings us to a more contemplative, questioning attitude. And then our own suffering, you know, just the difficulties we face as human beings, our fears and angers, our disappointments, our sicknesses, the family difficulties we have, and then the beautiful times, which we'd like to repeat, but sometimes we can't repeat. And so life itself presents its unsatisfactoriness to us. And fortunately, we have a way of addressing that, which isn't just a way of trying to distract all the time. You know, we have a way of actually addressing the causes of mental suffering. The causes of physical suffering, well, we do our best, and that's limited. But the causes of mental suffering, we can always address. So I might feel cold, right? And there's a difference between cold and being grumpy about cold, isn't there? The difference between feeling discomfort and feeling annoyed at the discomfort. There's a difference between something not going right and being angry at someone for it not going right. And that mental quality of suffering is in Buddhism, it's the key to liberation, because it's always pointing to some kind of misunderstanding or non-understanding that we have about life. And if we're willing to be conscious of our discontents and say, well, what assumptions am I making here to create this kind of inner suffering that I have, then that kind of questioning, contemplation will lead us to a solution. And that's the genius of the Buddha, that he takes the kind of common thing that we all have, suffering or discontent, disappointment, and that we don't want, but he actually asks us to look at it, awaken to it, and find out its causes internally, in consciousness, in our own minds. It's a very mature teaching. It's, you know, if one is into blame or into distraction, this won't be a very attractive teaching. So it's a certain level of maturity, spiritual maturity. So in terms of stream of consciousness, then, that's what we're working with. We have, you know, we have the structure of the retreat. We have, you know, Thai embassy's been sending food, and the three great sisters have been working diligently in the kitchen, and the bhikkhus have been organizing heating, and so on and so forth. All very good things, which has created a situation where we can do this. We can just give up to the form, participate and contribute what we can. But we have this kind of freedom now, just to watch how we react, how we respond to situations, to people, and what in that is peaceful and what is not peaceful. Why do we suffer? And so we're watching stream of consciousness, and the way in this sutta that we just recited, the contemplative becomes disenchanted with the nose. It's not that your nose is too big. It's the sense of smell becomes disenchanted with sights, becomes disenchanted with sounds, with tastes, with bodily feelings, and mental imagery, and emotions, and so on, and thoughts. And that word disenchanted is a good word, because it's, disenchantment isn't rejecting. It's not like saying that the smell of a rose it smells like the same as a dead dog. You know, the smell of the rose is different, and one prefers the smell of the rose. Most dead dogs probably prefer the smell of dead dogs, I suppose. I'm not sure. They have different nose trip. But disenchantment isn't a rejection of sense experience. It's just pointing to the to the way liberation works is that we no longer seek liberation in sense experience. We seek pleasure in sense experience. So I move now because my knee's hurting. So I get out of the pain to try to get comfortable. So there's nothing wrong with that. But to think that would be that liberation that the Buddha offered was through constantly moving my body or finding physical comfort, then I would have it wrong. But also to think that I just can't have any pleasure, that I should, no matter how much pain I have, I just have to sit through it, come hell or high water, and then I'll be okay. It's some kind of willful punishment of the body. That doesn't work either. So this enchantment is it's like, okay, you hear the helicopter now. Right? Now, or just like we were listening to the gunshots and the coyotes, quite interesting sitting outside, isn't it? It's quite alive out there. So if you don't like hunting, then your mind might have engaged the gunshots. Oh, it's terrible, they're shooting the animals again. It's really awful. That's not disenchantment, that's engagement. It's all very nice and good, but it's still engagement. Right? Terrible, terrible, terrible. Well, okay, it's terrible. Or me with the coyotes. I was just watching my own mind engage the coyotes. Oh, I don't know. Where are they? Are they in back there? I thought the den was back. Like, engagement. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, and it's quite natural. But the constant engagement and preoccupation and attachment to and fascination with sense objects makes you, I like the word unavailable. You're not available to the liberating experience of non-grasping. You're not available to go. Why? Because you're preoccupied. And so disenchantment, I think, for me, is a reflection on stop being preoccupied with thoughts. Stop being preoccupied with sights and sounds and emotions. Just know them as change. Don't attach to them, don't grasp them, and see what happens. And this is very hard to do. Very hard to do. There they go again, the coyotes. Because the world is such an attractive and compelling place. Sense consciousness is very, very compelling. Gunshots, I mean, that's very powerful. Just imagine war or something like that. Very, very kind of compelling. Our emotions are very, you know, very real stuff we experience. When you can be very angry at someone or very down on yourself or full of lust or whatever. They're very powerful energies we're dealing with. So disenchantment isn't all that easy. But I think disenchantment comes, for me, from first of all, a sense of what right understanding might be. And right understanding would it's very right understanding is very important to in order for us to understand why the Buddha is teaching the way he teaches, why he teaches about the three characteristics of impermanence, not self, and unsatisfactoriness, why he teaches dependent origination, causality, law of karma. Why does he, you know, what is it about those teachings? Why does he teach in that particular way? Why does he say that the sense consciousness is not where it's at? Well, because he realizes something which is not bound by sense consciousness. So his realization, again, and the phrases I often repeat are, the Buddha says that if there were, he talks about the unconditioned, the uncreated, he said there is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unborn, the deathless, Nibbana, peace, the island, the harbor. If there were not the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unborn, the deathless, there would be no release from conditions, from the conditioned, from the born, from the deathbound. There'd be no release from it. So that's one of the phrases I've used a lot as a contemplative phrase. And that point, you know, he's saying, if there weren't something other than sense experience, some realization other than just sense experience, then okay, go for it. Go maximize your pleasure. But we're doomed. But he says there is. He says there is an escape, or there is an out, and that is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the deathless. So then, if you look at sense consciousness, sights begin and end. They're born and die. Sounds begin and end. They're born and die. Smells begin and end. They're born and die. Physical feelings, tastes, begin and end. All the mental imagery, and emotions, and thoughts, they begin and they end. So that can't be where it's at. That can't be the unconditioned, because those are conditions. They're causally conditioned. So then the teaching talks about causality. With this, there is that. When this arises, that arises. So with cold air as condition, there is a feeling in the body of trembling or whatever. It's just natural. It's causality. So what is uncaused? What is not caused? And that contemplation, I think, leads to disenchantment. Disenchantment isn't like, you know, you have a divorce and you say, I'm never getting married again. That's that's disenchantment, certainly. But it's deeper than just like life is a bummer and then you die. It's not cynical. It's not cynical. It's wise. I would say it's wise because it's pointing to a fact that which begins ends, right? And if it begins and ends and it's causally related, I don't own it. I don't have control of it. It's not mine. And because it begins and it ends, and because it's causally related, and because I don't really own it, it's unsatisfactory. And it's unsatisfactory in relation to the Buddha's realization of Nibbana. So you get this strange kind of paradoxical statement that pleasure is unsatisfactory, which if you don't pick up on the subtlety of this analysis, you think, well, what do you mean pleasure is unsatisfactory? Pleasure is pleasure. I'd rather have pleasure than pain. Yeah, of course. But pleasure in itself is not the goal, because pleasure changes according to causes and conditions. So you begin to have disenchantment for pleasure. But that doesn't mean you sit on a bed of nails and hurt yourself. When life is pleasurable, you enjoy it. And it's just natural. It's like you appreciate a body free from pain, and you bear with a body that has pain. That's natural. But that's not the goal. So some kinds of pleasure can be a good foundation for enlightenment, like having a square meal, right? Having enough food in your belly and feeling warmth coursing through your body because you have enough nutrition. But to become a foodie, you know, where you know, I become like really refined in my taste in food, such that I can only eat certain kind of refined foods. Well, that's not it either, is it? Yeah. I can only drink Starbucks. I cannot drink that other brand. What is that? Tim Hortons coffee. You know, I'm a refined coffee nut. So we have appreciation. We have aesthetic appreciation. You know, we have things we like, and some people like coffee, some people like tea, and that's not wrong. But disenchantment with all that, you see its limit, don't you? You see its limit, and you don't make a big thing out of sense experience. It's no big deal. It is what it is. Now, you can be grateful. We can be grateful and appreciative. We certainly are for the lovely food that's being offered us, and the kindness and all that. We appreciate that. But disenchantment means our goal is much more profound. Our goal is much more profound. So then, when sights, sounds, tastes, and so on arise, and this is the way we define stream of consciousness. When we define the world in terms of our social reality, we define the world in terms of I am Viradamo, and I have certain responsibilities, and I have an email address, and my brother lives in Ottawa, and my teacher lives in Thailand, and I'm 67 years old, and so on and so forth, right? So this is the sort of social definition of me living in the world. But when we look at stream of consciousness, we let go of those conventions and we pick up another convention, and we look at body is body, sound is sound, taste is taste, sight is sight, emotion is emotion, thought is thought. We break away from the self-identity to try to just see these as stream of consciousness, phenomena in nature. Now that's hard to do, but that's the first step. And that we call letting go of personality view. And personality view is when we don't see stream of consciousness as just events arising and ceasing. It's when we get caught in ego identities. So, I feel pain in my leg, and the pain in the leg has a certain feeling to it, and I start thinking about when the sitting will end. A sense of self arises. How long can I sit here? Should I get up? Should I not get up? A sense of self arises. We can do that. That's the social part. But also, I can look at pain as pain. I can look at discomfort as discomfort before I go to the mental creations around it. And when I see pain as pain, discomfort as discomfort, I see it as dharma. I see it as dharma. And when I see it as dharma, I also see the dharma of wanting and the dharma of engagement and the dharma of attachment. And I say, okay, that's the challenge. My constant engagement with pleasure and pain prevents me from being available to the transcendent. So then as a contemplative, I start to work with that. I feel you know, some kind of emotional discomfort or physical discomfort. And rather than run with a storyline, I begin to see how discomfort is a dharma that has arisen, and it stays for a while and then it ceases. I begin to get the perspective of change, which I've been encouraging. And as I do that, and I notice like preferences and desires coming up, and I just watch them as phenomena in the flow of consciousness, feeling of not wanting and wanting, feeling of trying to get rid of. I see those now more and more objectively. I don't get caught in them. I begin to see that my awareness now is available because I'm not caught up. I'm not caught up in storylines. I'm not caught up in narratives. I'm not trying to get a good experience or get rid of a bad experience. I begin to let go of desire. And that's the third noble truth, the abandonment of desire, of the craving for getting something in the future, or the rejection of what is in the present, or just the kind of absorption into sense experience, just that coolness of mind which just knows desire arising and ceasing. And then I begin to see that now there's availability in spans of time where I don't get lost, but the awareness is available. Consciousness is available to how things are. And I begin to intuit that very availability is the key. Because I begin to see that availability, that awareness of change, is always actually there. It's not the same as like hot and cold, or sweet and sour, or emotion, no emotion. It's different. Because it's not a quality. It's not really like an experience. Awareness is not an experience. Awareness of fear is an experience. Awareness of doubt is experience. But awareness itself is not, hasn't got the same characteristics to it. And I begin to be curious about awareness itself. I begin to be aware of awareness. Why? Because I'm disenchanted with sights and sound, the whole stream of consciousness. I'm disenchanted with that which changes. Now that takes a certain amount of faith. Like the Buddha saying, there is something which is unchanging, deathless. Deathless does not mean immortal. It means it doesn't begin and end. It's a different kind of idea, difficult idea. But that is what the Buddha, the teaching is trying to get that contemplative part of our minds to really ponder deeply, not just try to figure it out intellectually and have an answer which then someone refutes or agrees with. That's just mental. But contemplation is more like you take a theme and you say, well, what do I think about that? Or what does he mean by that? And you start to, so you take the theme of conditionality and unconditioned. Change was unchanging. All right. Now you can't figure that. You have to watch your mind. You have to observe your mind. This is the contemplative life rather than just the opinionated life. You can have people will come at you with their Buddhist opinions who don't know how to meditate. And they're very clever and argue maybe more cleverly than you, but they don't necessarily understand anything. It's just an opinion. A Buddhist opinion as opposed to a Christian opinion. It's just an opinion. But contemplation is not an opinion. It's like taking a teaching and digging deeply to watch. Okay, what is unconditioned? Huh? Now, if you take that kind of contemplation, well, what's unconditioned? And you say, well, okay, you notice your body's changing, and you begin to just be, well, the closest thing to get to that would be awareness, wouldn't it? And awareness is not a quality. Awareness knows, and you begin to be curious about the knowing itself. And you begin to cast awareness on awareness, rather than being caught up with the mental objects and physical objects, sights and sounds. And then the mind goes very silent, because there's no thought in there. If you have a thought, oh, awareness is the deathless, that's just a thought. It's not going to help you. It'd be opinion, and then someone says, no, it's not. And you can have an argument, but that's just thought. But actually, to go beyond thought, the conclusion you reach is that thought is skillful, but thought has a limit because it is conditioned. All thoughts are conditioned by culture. They begin and they end. They're based on perceptions and opinions and philosophies and so on. So you begin to see the limits of thought, the hopelessness of thought to realize the unconditioned, because thought is a condition. So you begin to appreciate just present, silent knowing of the way things are. And then you use things like observing change. And of course, you see how difficult that is. Why? Because desire comes up, you get bored, boredom comes up, you don't see boredom, and you run with something interesting. So when the mind gets kind of neutral and calm, desire mind comes up and you go start fantasizing or shopping or whatever. And then all manner of things which you get caught up. And you begin to see, how can I develop a mind which is focused and centered? And this is samadhi. The capacity to bear awareness on the present moment for spans of time. It's samadhi. And that's what it's one of the things we're training in. Not to achieve some super state, because anything you achieve would be in time, and time would be about death. So you have the kind of spiritual or religious language of immanence and transcendence. You find that in most mystical tradition. Immanent means it's always here and now. So in Buddhism, akaliko, not a matter of time. Immanence. Transcendence means it's not a sense experience. Transcendence isn't a good word sometimes for people because it has flaky connotations, I suppose. I don't know. So people sometimes they oppose me if I use that word. But that's in mystical or spiritual literature, you'll find this immanent and transcendent. So that's not a position you're taking. It's just like, because language is so limited, especially around these kinds of things, you kind of fumble for language. But immanent, what does immanent mean? Immanent means it's always here now, not a matter of time. So if you take that deeply, then you realize that any sense of trying to get enlightened in the future is wrong. Because that very sense of time is a sense of self. I want to become something, and that can't be wrong. So you start to give up time. Time becomes very significant in the insights around liberation. Not a matter of time, akaliko. That's very profound. If you take it, if you take it deeply, not a matter of time. So when people say to me, "Well, I'll be enlightened next lifetime," that's very dualistic, very time bound. I'm just a little Mickey Mouse Buddhist. I can never get enlightened. And that's self-view. But if you just see the perception, I am a Mickey Mouse Buddhist, and I will never get enlightened, and you stop your mind, you're available. But if you take that perception, oh yeah, I'm not really up to the mark, I just have to really work hard, you know, maybe 6 more retreats and I'll get a bit of samadhi, and then next lifetime, that's all delusion. And it, you know, it sounds very humble, but it's actually conceited. Because the conceit that I'm hopeless or I'm great is still conceit, isn't it? I'm a terrible, terrible person. I'm the cat's meow. Still conceit. I'm anything is still conceit. So humility, sometimes, true humility is not self. You know, you don't take it personally. That's true humility. But self-disparagement is the same as arrogance. It has a different quality. It's socially more palatable. You know, we prefer people who are self-disparaging because they're not threatening. Arrogant people get up our nose. But it's still the same design flaw, isn't it? I'm no good, I'm great. It's still I am this or I am that. But the observation of flow of consciousness is, the I am has arisen and it can be known. It has arisen as a thought, as a feeling. And it arises and it ceases. And what does it arise and cease in? In awareness. And you begin to not to believe the self-perceptions that I am anything, and begin to see that time itself, the perception of time, is an object. And this is the curious thing about being human, is that we can only know the present moment. We can only know the past as a memory and the future as a projection, as an anticipation or whatever. We can only know the present moment. And yet we so believe in time. You know, we believe, you know, I was, you know, show you all my passport when I was born and when I came into Canada. And it's true on a conventional sense, because I don't have a 20-year-old body, that's for sure. This is a 67-year-old body. But the Buddha is saying that's not who I am. That's not who you are. That identity is not wrong in the sense of responsibility, but in the sense of a spiritual possibility, that identity limits you. Right? So the Buddha is saying, the body is the body. It's a formation of nature. Know it that way, as anicca dukkha-anatta. Feelings are feelings. They arise and cease according to nature. Thoughts, memories arise and cease according to nature. Be the knowing. Be the knowing of change. Lompo Samedi used to give those talks a lot. I remember Chithurst, he'd say, What does a Buddha know that others don't know? That which has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease, is not self. And when one is allowing that perception to function, the mind goes quiet. The mind goes quiet. And then sustaining that perception opens one to the profundity of awareness. And what begins to happen is the sense of the doer falls away. The sense of the meditator, the sense of the critic, the judge, the attainer of this or that, or the failing person, that whole sense of being a person, especially the sense of doing, becoming, that begins to see in itself as a kind of restlessness. And that, as that is known, there comes a time when it's like consciousness has just pure perception, and the sense of self falls away, which we define as a deeper understanding of anatta, or emptiness. So in the beginning, the teachings around anatta are sakkaya ditti, just this sense of I am a terrible person, or I'm a great person, or I have my history. And you begin to see that as just an object in consciousness, something that arises and ceases according to stimulations of various sorts. And then as you disbelieve that, as you become disenchanted with thought and self-definition and all the rest of it, all the emotional stuff that we carry, become disenchanted with that. You don't reject it. You just that's just stuff. You just don't believe it anymore. You become more available. And in that availability, the awareness knows change. That is sustained for longer periods of time. And all of a sudden, there's pure perception. And the sense of self falls away. The doer falls away. You know, well, that was just a construct too. And this is the what we mean by emptiness. And this is a deeper level of anatta, a deeper understanding, a deeper realization. So the life of a Buddhist contemplative is much more than just rearranging our psychology to be more comfortable. It's much more profound than that. Psychology is important. Getting the emotional life balance is it's very helpful because it makes you happy. And if you're happy, then you tend to not need stuff. If you don't need stuff, you can become disenchanted with stuff. Become disenchanted with stuff, you're more available. You're more available, there's a deeper possibility of peace and insight. So, metta practice, not dumping on people, all those are good. But they're not the goal. They're the method. Compassion is the method. Kindness is the method. Generosity is the method. Morality is the method. Because they lay a foundation of peace. And then from that, it's a kind of springboard for the unconditioned. All right? I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayam dhammagataya sadhu karang dadamase
sadhu sadhu.